Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Friday, so let's turn right to our week in review, and we'll start with yet another big week in politics. Today, President Trump said he will sign the budget deal that Congress passed to avoid another government shutdown. The president also declared a national emergency in an effort to build the wall.
We're going to be signing today and registering national emergency. And it's a great thing to do.
Also this week, another Democrat from Massachusetts, Congressman Seth Moulton, says he's considering a run for president.
When I look at my four-month-old daughter and say, I don't want her growing up in this world, I feel like there might be an opportunity for me to do more.
And as we heard, former Republican governor from Massachusetts, Bill Weld, says he's also considering a presidential run.
We have a president whose priorities are skewed towards promotion of himself rather than toward the good of the country.
But the president says he's just doing what's necessary to protect the country. And we're going to unpack all of this, so let's dive right in. And to help us break it all down, we're joined by Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, welcome back to Radio Washington.
Hi, nice to be here.
Always good to have you. Also here with us is John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and a blogger at It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, welcome back to you as well.
Nice to be here.
Okay, so let's start with what we saw from President Trump earlier today. Here he is again from the Rose Garden.
And what we really want to do is simple. It's not like it's complicated. It's very simple. We want to stop drugs from coming into our country. We want to stop criminals and gangs from coming into our country. Nobody's done the job that we've ever done. I mean, nobody's done the job that we've done on the border.
All right. So he declared a national emergency. John Carroll, I'll start with you. What's your response to this? Obviously, this is going to lead to pushback from the Democrats, lawsuits. What do you make of this?
Right. I mean, this is pretty much an unprecedented move on the part of Donald Trump. National emergencies have been declared before, dozens and dozens of them. Even national emergencies to move around military money have been called. George H.W. Bush called one in right before the Persian Gulf War. George W. Bush declared a national emergency after the 9/11 attacks. They were shifting around military money in response to current events. Donald Trump is doing something that is really end-running the separation of powers in terms of the legislative branch's ability to appropriate money. And what he is doing essentially is breaking down the separation of powers and assuming for himself something that that the Constitution does not allow him to do. So this is going to be interesting. Also, you know, at one point, Donald Trump called this kind of move dangerous, unconstitutional, and impeachable when Barack Obama was using executive orders. So this is something where Trump is way out on a limb, and we'll see whether the courts saw that limb off or not.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we know that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, two Democrats, of course, they put out a joint statement calling this a power grab. And some in the president's own party, among them Senator Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, for example, have been outspoken critics of declaring this emergency. Arlene, where do you see this taking us?
Well, it's partly laughable. Everyone anticipated that there was a high likelihood that Trump would do this. So no one is really shocked. The question is whether there was an implicit or explicit agreement with McConnell that I'll accept this bill, but then I'm going to say I want an emergency declaration and you have to back me up, which, of course, McConnell did, in fact, capitulate, even though prior to McConnell saying he would agree, Republican senators like Collins and Tillis and Roy Blunt had all come out and said, don't do an emergency declaration. The irony is that not only is it not an emergency, but Trump essentially admitted that today in his press conference, no more than 3 moments after he said, I'm declaring an emergency. He goes on about how, well, I didn't really need to do this because I could do the wall anytime, take a longer time. I just wanted to do it faster. So he thoroughly undercut the action he was assisting he needed to do.
He also made it very clear that he expects this to end up in the courts. Here's a little bit of what he said.
And we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there. and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court, just like the ban.
It's kind of a rhythm there, John.
It's a little Seussian, I think.
what do you make of this? I mean, he's got that right in the sense that it's going to go through the courts.
Right. I think the thing he's got wrong is he thinks he's got the Supreme Court in his pocket. And even the conservatives on the court are very, very reluctant to allow this kind of poaching in terms of the separation of powers, to allow the executive branch to expand its reach in that way. I think is something that that most of the court is going to find unacceptable. We'll see, but he's confident that the Supreme Court is on his side. I think the only people who are really on his side are Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh at this point. You know, he's got this cable cabinet that he's appealing to, and it's really leading him astray in many ways, I think.
You know, there's also another variable, which is there's been a lot of talk in D.C. about the fact that the National Emergency Act allows Congress to disapprove of national emergency declarations. And if, in fact, that happens in the House and it did pass, which is likely, then the Senate apparently would trigger a mandatory vote in the Senate, which could ultimately block the emergency action.
And lead to a Trump veto.
And lead to a Trump veto, because it probably wouldn't be a veto-proof vote in the Senate, right? Yeah, interesting. One more thing I want to bring up about this, then move on, because we've got a bunch of other stuff to talk about. The president claimed during this press conference that Democrats have been lying about how drugs get into this country. Here's what he said.
And when you listen to politicians, in particular certain Democrats, they say it all comes through the port of entry. It's wrong. It's wrong. It's just a lie. It's all a lie. They say walls don't work. Walls work 100%.
Now, here's the thing. According to the DEA's 2018 drug threat assessment, the vast majority of drugs come into the country through the southern border do, in fact, come through ports of entry. So I want to say that, make sure I said that clearly. The vast majority of drugs coming into the country across the southern border do, in fact, come through ports of entry. So it sounds like this is another case where the president is rejecting data provided by his own administration.
He's deeply invested in not letting the facts get in the way of policy.
Yeah. Well, you saw this press conference, which is the typical freewheeling Donald Trump press conference. The fact checkers were actually going to see a chiropractor afterwards, because there were so many things that Donald Trump said that were either misleading or false. And it's true. He doesn't care for his own experts. He cares for only his gut instincts, which lead him to make decisions like this.
Yeah. And also, it has to be pointed out, this is one of the central promises of his campaign. And it's a promise that continues to animate his core supporters. So there's that to consider as well. But we need to move on, because there's a lot of other stuff that happened this week. And I want to come to former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld announcing this morning that he's forming an exploratory committee. Arlene, what do you make of the former governor of this great state declaring essentially a challenge to Trump, a possible primary challenge to President Trump?
Well, I worked both for and against Bill Weld for many years when he was governor here. And I certainly like what he said today. I love the fact that he poetically but right on point said that Trump may have raw talent, but he doesn't use it in ways that promote democracy, truth, justice, or equal opportunity. That was spot on. And Weld is, of course, significantly brighter than Trump, and more thoughtful, and a heck of a lot more charming. But I think this is going to be an impossible task. I mean, yes, it's true he'll get independents votes and some moderate Republicans. But at the end of the day, I think Trump has a lock on the Republican nomination.
A lock on the Republican nomination, John. But we heard in the first segment, Fergus Cullen up in New Hampshire sort of made the point that maybe a challenge like this wounds Trump sufficiently and draws votes away from him in the general election. What do you think?
It's possible. I mean, you know, the thing about Donald Trump is, you know, he has a ceiling, but he has a floor as well. Mm-hmm. And his floor isn't going anywhere. The other aspect of this is Bill Weld may not get to challenge Donald Trump, because there are rumblings in the GOP that they want to bypass the primary system this time around. In South Carolina, the GOP chair says, I don't think we need a primary here. We'll do whatever in the best interest of the president. One, our Republican National Committee official has said, the RNC should just endorse Trump and forget about all this primary stuff. So that's going to be an interesting gambit if they go down that route, and whether there'll be backlash to that or not.
I want to come back, though, to William Weld and just sort of ask this question about how serious this is. Because on the one hand, he was a serious governor. He served for almost two terms. He was highly regarded. But since then, there's been a sort of quixotic nature to sort of the directions he's taking. I mean, trying to run for governor of New York, to then abandoning the party. I'm free at last. I'm a libertarian, running for vice president as a libertarian in 2016. Now he's back in the Republican Party. Arlene, doesn't this sort of, I don't know, detract a little bit from his credibility?
There is that pattern of what day is it or what year is it and where is Bill Weld politically. I saw that issue-wise. He, when he was first ran for governor in Massachusetts, some people heralded him the gay hero. Others challenged that, but he was on the cover of a gay magazine for being so wonderful. But no sooner was he in than he didn't want to support domestic partner health insurance benefits. He was for same-sex marriage before he was against same-sex marriage when he moved to New York and wanted to run for another office. So he's been a little bit all over the map on some things, and that's going to hurt him.
So let's move on to another Massachusetts politician. This is Seth Moulton, the congressman. He declared this week that he's taking a very hard look at running in 2020. He was asked for a long time, are you running? He said he wasn't. Then he said he wasn't sure. And anyway, here is what he said on Monday, speaking at Salem State University.
We need new ideas in our politics. We need new leadership in our politics. I've been fighting to get new leaders elected the last 2 years. And that's why I'm looking at running.
So, John, another Massachusetts politician looking at running. What do you make of Seth Moulton's effort here?
Well, it's going to be interesting for Seth Moulton because he knocked heads with Nancy Pelosi very publicly, and Nancy Pelosi right now is a rock star in the Democratic Party. So I think he's going to be carrying that baggage. Interestingly, Rochelle Cohen in the Boston Globe, I believe yesterday or today, wrote about Seth Moulton. The only one talking about foreign policy in terms of the nascent Democratic field. But the other thing is, I would say 75% of the people who are jumping into the Democratic race for the presidential nomination are campaigning for vice president. And I think that Seth Moulton falls into that category.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned the thing about foreign policy, and he gave a speech on Tuesday at the Brookings Institute on the future of defense in America. He's a former Marine, of course. He did multiple tours of service in Iraq. Arlene, what do you think about that? I mean, is that a lane that could sort of open up to someone like Seth Moulton, the sort of foreign policy expert, I guess?
Well, he's got good credentials when it comes to being a veteran and having volunteered to serve. I don't think that necessarily makes him at all an expert on foreign policy. However, I think some of the people who have been in Congress and the Senate a lot longer would have that. So, yes, it does give him a lane, but I think he's not quite ready for prime time. He is, however, as John pointed out, there a lot of them are running for vice president, just not in name yet.
Really interesting, yeah. Well, on to a story that broke yesterday. So General Electric has announced that it's abandoning plans to build a 12-story office building in the Seaport District in Boston and will instead sell the property. The company has said it will reimburse the state's $87 million investment in the proposed headquarters. And this story comes on the heels of news that Amazon has also abandoned its plans for a new headquarters in New York after heavy pushback from local lawmakers and activists who are upset over the financial breaks the company was given. So two big companies in two big cities that made generous offers to bring the companies in. John, what's your reaction to this news?
Well, the GE move you could see coming a mile away. I mean, this is the incredible shrinking corporation.
Yeah.
And they have been downsizing for a couple of years now. And so I think that it's no surprise that they're going to back out. And unfortunately, what's happening is the 800 jobs that they projected that they would be bringing to Boston when they moved here from Connecticut has shrunk by over 500. So there may be 250, and a whole lot of them are already working here. So I think that's a disappointment that's leading people to re-examine these sweetheart deals. down in New York, I mean, Amazon didn't even put up a fight. It was amazing that they just folded their tent. And a number of people are saying, you know, this thing was a charade all along, that this was a marketing move by Amazon. It was a data collection move by Amazon to basically figure out where they want to put their new warehouses and distribution centers. And essentially, they're not even going to replace the New York facility. Really interesting contrast with Google, which is building a $1 billion campus in New York along the Hudson River, and they are getting zero in incentives. So I think that Amazon looked bad here. Amazon didn't really want to fight because they didn't really care that much. And they walked out. And for Bill de Blasio to say Amazon's not tough enough to make it in the big town, you know, Bill de Blasio was one of the ones who engineered the $3 billion sweetheart deal. So, you know, he can't have it both ways.
Interesting. Well, so to come back to GE in Boston, here's Somerville Mayor Joseph Curtatone. He told WBUR yesterday that this is a lesson in how cities handle big companies that are considering expanding or establishing a presence in cities.
Because a major company comes in that you didn't expect or is looking for a place to be, you know, the challenge for us is to, again, take a deep breath, understand what we're trying to accomplish, and not just lead with giving away the resources that we that are so critical for our community success.
So, Arlene, does he have a point there that cities need to, you know, I don't know, think a little harder before they make these really sweet offers to these companies? What do you
Absolutely.
Think?
Absolutely. I think it's honestly, this kind of corporate welfare is egregiously inappropriate. I agree with Michelle Wu that there has to be a lot more transparency and a lot more stringent standards when they do that. And there need to be clawback provisions that if you don't do what you say you're going to do, you got to give back the money. Now, it appears some of those clawbacks may have existed here. But I really question why the deals were made to begin with, because there's been a bad history in this state of these things failing. 20-some-odd years ago, the state gave a tax cut special for Raytheon. They did one specially for Fidelity. Hmm. And guess what? Fidelity took the money, and now they're in Rhode Island. You know, Raytheon promised to have jobs, a certain number of jobs. It never happened. So we've got to be careful about that. But I question the fundamental concept of why in the world we are subsidizing private corporations to move into highly desirable areas where companies are tripping over themselves to get a piece of action in that part of the city. Now, I understand an argument could be made if it was a depressed area of the city, if like, oh, we're going to move to Mattapan and help economic development, or we're going to do a kind of work that needs to be done, like renewable energy, wind, solar, whatever. Right. But none of those are the case here. And I think this deal, both at the city and the state level, should those incentives, those subsidies should never have been made.
Well, anyway, it's ended up where it's ended up. So sort of back to square one in a way. I want to move on to a story that we learned about this week. According to a new study, Boston has the worst rush hour traffic in the country, worse than L.A. So here's Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation Stephanie Pollack. We talked to her earlier this week on the program. You can imagine the shock that she expressed about this study.
I think people who commute in the Boston area did not need a study to tell them that we have a congestion problem.
Okay, so I think we all agree that it's pretty obvious that we have a congestion problem. But, John, were you surprised at all that Boston is and by the way, the methodology of this study was that it doesn't necessarily mean that Boston commuters have the worst commute. What it means that at peak rush hour, they're moving the slowest. And so that's how it measured it.
Right. And the estimate is, you know, they lost 164 hours. Those drive time drivers lost, you know, $2,200. I'm not sure how they calculated that. Just for the record, I walked here. So, so you know, this doesn't bother me. But what did confuse me was the response from Stephanie Pollack and from Mayor Marty Walsh. I mean, Stephanie Pollack says basically what people care about is their total commute time. Well, that's exactly what this is about. I don't understand that part. And Marty Walsh said, well, this is only 50% of the issue because, only 50% of the people coming in the city are in cars. Well, that's the whole point. So, you know, Stephanie Pollack says, well, we really need to know why. Why is this happening? And you can look in a couple of areas, and one's Uber and one's Lyft, and a big one is the MBTA, which is like somebody's hobby that they lost interest in. It is just the most unreliable mass transit system imaginable.
So in defense of, and I feel like I need to step in here because we spoke to Stephanie Pollack, and in defense of her position, she made a big case that $8 billion invested in the improvement and you know, upgrading the maintenance and tracks and switches and new Green Line cars and a whole bunch of things to make the MBTA run a whole lot better. I just want to put that out
okay,
there.
And
that's
to,
what she says.
Not to get technical about it, but just this week, you know, three of the four lines were down because of power problems.
This
so,
is true.
So, yeah. And it wasn't even cold. So, you know, people have different opinions about this. I'm the minority view, probably.
No, I'm not sure. There are a lot of frustrated commuters out there who I think might agree with you. But Arlene, what was your response to this?
Well, study? You know, I appreciate Pollard's thoughtfulness about we have to study it. And on the one hand, that can be fine, except the fact of the matter is this is not a new problem. It's just a problem that's getting worse and worse. And to me, this is a pay now or save later phenomenon. I mean, the answer is not rocket science. We need a lot more public transportation, significant expansion. You know, in the business world, there's an expression where they say you have to spend money to make money. Well, in the government world, sometimes you have to spend money to save money. And if they don't take care of the problem of the mass transportation now when it's cold, it'll develop into pneumonia and it'll be a lot more costly later. That study said that it's costing drivers $2,300 a year in congestion costs. You take all that money and you put it into mass transit and you expand the MBTA and we'd all be a lot better off.
Well, I want to make sure we leave some time for the hubbubs, those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. John, let me start with you. What was your hubbub?
My hubbub is the state of absolute chaos at the Boston Globe comics pages.
God, thank God someone's paying attention.
Two months ago, the Boston Globe dumps 11 comic strips, gets a bad reaction from readers, comes back, reinstates four of them this week. That's only part of the problem. The other part of the problem is one of the comics that they kept was one called Non Sequitur. And on Sunday, they ran a strip that had hidden in it an invitation to Donald Trump to do something that is anatomically impossible. So this was something that started driving newspapers away from to dump Non Sequitur. The Boston Globe finally did it yesterday after about five dozen papers had done it. And they have brought back Zippy, which is a good call, I think. They also implied that there are more changes in the offing in the comics page. I say stop the madness, leave the comics pages alone, or else bring back all the strips.
Arlene, are you a supporter of Zippy? Or you can offer me your own hubbub.
Well, I'll point to a local newspaper where the Beacon Hill Times ran a great story this week listing what's going on next week, school vacation week, and the Freedom Trail. And they talk about all these wonderful events from history tours that you can take and you can celebrate Black History Month with an African-American Patriot Tour. There's free ice skating at certain times and days next week. There's a children's festival. You can go to King's Chapel and tour the bell tower where it was recast by Paul Revere. There are all these amazing things happening in the city. We're so lucky to live in a place with incredible history. I hope people take advantage of it and bring their kids to some of these venues.
All right. That's great advice. So here's my hubbub. It's about the Pawtucket Red Sox, the Red Sox AAA affiliate, which is going to be moving to Worcester in 2021. So the Globe, and I credit the Globe, they just posted an amusing piece about the perilous high stakes question of what to call the team. They're going to be the Worcester Red Sox, but what about the nickname, which is apparently really important part of the marketing. So the team invited fans to submit suggestions, and they've been receiving, I guess, over 1,000. So here are some of them, because I think they're great. The Worcester Meatballs. Is Worcester known for meatballs? I don't know.
Not to my knowledge.
The Worcester Tongue Slingers. I don't even know what a tongue slinger is. Okay, but I still like the sound of it. The Worcester Mitten Kittens. Who thought of that? And I don't understand what that, but still, it's amusing. So, and this suggestion must have come from someone in Rhode Island. The Worcester Traders. I like that. And here's some with a decidedly local flavor. The Worcester Chowderheads. the Worcester Triple Deckers. And, of course, the favorite of many, the Worcester Mass Holes, which I think I can say on the air.
Anyway, I hope so.
In a way, I just did. Yeah. So Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Really appreciate having you. And John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and blogger at It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, always great to have you.
Thanks. And what's wrong with Woo Socks? It's got a cheer already built into it.
That's a good one. That's a winner, John. That's a winner. Stay with us. There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston.